From the Geneva Series of Commentaries, 2 Peter, Alexander Nisbet. Because the prevailing of error ordinarily brings with it a great decay of grace and holiness. Therefore the Apostle, having in the first part of this epistle, chapter 1, press a study of growth and grace and diligence and holy duties, does in this chapter, which is the second part, guard against the infection of error. And for this end, he gives forewarning of the rise and prevalency of false teachers in the church of the New Testament, especially such as are under a pretense of liberty through Jesus Christ, would lose the reins to all licentiousness, as appears by comparing the first and the 19th verses. He at large describes them by such clear characters taken from their abominable doctrine and vile practices as might make them known and hateful to all the Lord's people. He threatens them with no less terrible judgments than ever had come upon the vilest sinners that ever lived, that so all might be afraid to drink in their errors. And fourthly, he holds out to the godly some grounds of confidence to be made use of by them for their preservation both from their errors and plagues. These four are the principal parts of the chapter, which are not handled apart but often intermixed throughout the whole of it, as will appear by a particular view of the sum of it. The Apostle forewarns of the rise of these soul seducers, describing them from the strain and tendency of their doctrine, together with the hazard of it to themselves and their followers. First, from the success they should have. Verse 2, from their way of prevailing and certainty of their judgment. Verse 3, which last he confirms by a threefold example of God's judgment upon the angels, the old world and Sodom, intermixing therewith a twofold example of the Lord's preserving of Noah and Lot as pledges of his respect to his own in all times of the prevailing of sin and judgment, verses 4 to 8, both which he applies for the comfort of the godly and terror of the wicked, verse 9, especially of such soul deceivers and their followers as had given themselves to the service of their lusts, wherein they were so bold and self-pleasing that they labored to disgrace all lawful authority and might oppose them, verse 10, which then he aggravates from the carriage of the good angels who honor magistracy, verse 11, and from their likeness to the beast by reason of it, an undervalue in that whereof they know not the worth, and violent prosecuting of their lusts and pleasures, gain and glory, for which he threatens that their end shall be worse than the beasts. Verses 12 to 14, and for their apostasy from the truth for gain and other idols, which no less violently they pursue, Balaam did, verse 15, with no opposition, even extraordinary, could restrain them, verse 16, and for their many fair pretenses in which they did ensnare poor souls, once brought from paganism to Christianity, verses 17 to 19, for all which, especially their apostasy after so great a change externally, he threatens them and their followers with more wrath than ever, if they had not known and professed as they did, verses 20 and 21, which apostasy he shows is not to be stumbled at in regard that they, still retaining their unrenewed nature, are only gone back like dogs and swine to their seemingly renounced errors and sins, verse 22. 2 Peter 1, verse 1. But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. The Apostle brings in the forewarning of the rise of heretics, both with guarding against offense thereat, upon this ground, that had been the lot of the church before, and with this describing them from this, that they should cunningly convey into the church and minds of people such errors as would bring damnation upon themselves, and all that should receive and continue in them, of which errors he gives an instance, that they should deny the Lord that bought them, which is not to be understood as if either Christ had died for such men, for then they could not have perished, John 10, 11, and 28, or as if they had expressly denied Christ to be the Redeemer, for then could they not have prevailed as they did with professors of Christ, nor had their words been feigned as they are said to be, but upon blasphemy. The meaning, therefore, is that they, being by profession, and in their own and others' esteem, redeemed ones, should vent such errors as would in substance tend to the denial of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ over his people by laboring under a pretense of Christian liberty. Verse 19, to loose believers from their subjection to Christ's royal law, for which he threatened speedy judgments to come upon them, as if they had expressly denied him after they had been redeemed by him. Hence learn first, it has ordinarily been, and so will continue the lot of the church, to be troubled with false teachers. The wise Lord so disposed them that he may have a proof of his people's love to him by their constant adherence to his opposed truth. Deuteronomy 13, verse 3, 2 Corinthians 11, 13. That he may make his truth the more clear and lovely to his own, Titus 1, verse 9. That he may justly punish with strong delusion them that receive not the truth and love, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11. And that his own in no time may stumble at what has been the lot of the church in all times. For to guard against offense at such a lot, and to stir up all to the study and esteem of the written word, which the apostle had commended in the close of the former chapter, for he forewarns them. But there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you. The way that seducers bring in error into the church and minds of the people is not easily discerned, it being often mixed with many precious truths. Verse 19, filled with odd and heavenly-like expressions, Romans 16, verse 18, with a pretense of singular piety, and inventors of it, and of much love to the welfare of the souls they seduce, Galatians 4, 17, and borne in mainly upon the simplest sort of professors. By these and the like artifices do men privily bring in damnable heresies. Error, no less than the vilest practice in the world, may bring damnation upon the souls of people, especially if it be freely and voluntarily chosen. Not for terror or compulsion, as the word heresy signifies, if it do either expressly or in substance destroy any of Christ's offices, or the way of salvation through him, and rending of the church. All which are here made ingredients of heresy, which the apostle calls damnable, and such as will bring upon them that receive, vent and continue in them, swift destruction, because Christ is engaged to keep them from perdition, John 6, verse 39. Yet, reprobates who do profess themselves to be redeemed by Christ, and are esteemed for such by the church, may be said to deny the Lord that bought them, in the terms of judicial process when they say he has redeemed them, and in the meantime in doctrine and deeds do deny and betray him. Howsoever in the terms of historical narration, they were never redeemed, nor written in the book of life. Even as apostates, in the terms of judicial process, are said to trample Christ under their feet, Hebrews 10, verse 29, which in the terms of historical narration is impossible, because our Lord was long before that time. The apostle did write this, bodily ascended into heaven, and was beyond the reach of any such bodily injury. And as the Amalekite in 2 Samuel 1, 16 is charged for killing the Lord's anointed, albeit the history tells us that he was slain before he came to him, because his own mouth testified so much against him, so may reprobate hypocrites crept into the church visible, calling Christ their Redeemer, and yet proven in effect bodily enemies to him, be charged for denying the Lord that bought them, because their own mouths and deeds testify so much against them. 2 Peter 2, verse 2, and many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be spoken of. Following the success of these sectaries, held forth in two branches, one that they should have a numerous party to back them in their soul-destroying courses, number two that they and their followers should prevail to bring saving truth into disgrace among many. Doctrine. It is not strange to see the most dangerous heretics have many followers, every error being a friend to some lust, 2 Timothy 4, verse 3, and having often more of prosperity and applause attending it than truth, 1 Corinthians 4, 8-10, and because of activity and fair pretenses of them that vented, Matthew 23, verse 15, Romans 16, verse 18, For these and the like causes many shall follow their pernicious ways. Secondly, they that are left of God to the leading of the spirit of error do not only enslave their judgments to their seducers, but also give up themselves to back them in all the courses they take to propagate their errors and increase their faction, even although these courses no less than their errors are destructive to the honor of Christ and welfare of souls. For the apostle says, many shall follow not only their errors, which he called damnable before, but their ways, which are called pernicious. Number 3, as error is received, truth goes out of request, the lovers of it, bending all their wit to disgrace those truths that discover the vileness of their errors. Romans 3, verse 8, and to raise and keep up hot contests among the professors of the gospel. Galatians 1, 7, thereby giving occasion to a third party who resolved to side with none but to slander, as the word is, blaspheme the whole profession of Christianity, Romans 2, verse 24. For the apostle here makes a slandering of truth the consequence of embracing error and points at a third party who would take occasion from heretics prevailing to slander them, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of, chapter 2, verse 3. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time does not linger, and their damnation does not slumber. Now follows a way how these false teachers came to have so great success. It is held forth in two branches. Their immoderate desire of gain and glory made them very industrious. And secondly, their figurative or plaster language, as the word signifies, made them easily gain a number of poor souls to be completely at their disposal, as wares, or under the power of the merchant that has bought them, for which dealing he forewarns that God's watchful providence was framing his decreed judgments for them. Hence we may learn, however they that seduce souls by error may seem to be the most mortified men in the world, Colossians 2, verse 23, and most desirous of the good of souls, Galatians 4, verse 17. Yet all their pains with people arise from some unmortified lust, such as the immoderate desire of gain or applause. For the Spirit of the Lord is in this to be believed, that whatever they pretend, through their covetousness they make merchandise of his people. In their way of dealing with souls, false teachers are very like to cheating merchants, and are using a much fair and plaster language to commend their errors. In their activity in stirring from place to place, as the word in the original, of making merchandise, signifies, to vent them. And number 3, in their unsatisfiableness, until their followers become their complete slaves, both in judgment and practice. All which is held forth as clear resemblances between them and cheating merchants. In these words, with feigned words, they shall make merchandise of you. However, the judgment of such men be hardly believed, because of their success and fair pretenses, and may be long suspended for the exercise of the godly and punishment of those who, by reason of strong delusion, don't receive the love of the truth. Yet it is most certain, according to the foreknowledge and decree of God, it is swiftly approaching and shall light upon them by way of surprise. For their judgment now of a long time does not linger, and their damnation does not slumber. Chapter 2, verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and delivered them in the chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. The apostle proves the certainty of the judgment threatened against these false teachers by a threefold instance, and this in the following verses. The substance of the first, which is in this verse, is that if the holy Lord did not spare the angels, his most glorious creatures, when they sinned against him, but did presently imprison them in a pit of hell, reserving them for further judgment, These false teachers and their followers have no reason to dream of exemption. Which conclusion, flowing from this and the following instances, the apostle finds not necessary to express, but leaves to their own conscience to infer. Doctrine number 1. Although it be ordinary for sinners to harden themselves against threatenings because of their excellences and privileges conferred upon them by the Lord, Revelation 18, verse 7, yet nothing of that kind can shelter them from the wrath of a provoked God. But the more of these gifts there are that are abused, the greater measure of wrath may be expected. Therefore is the judgment of God upon these excellent and privileged creatures, the angels, brought to prove the certainty of the like wrath to come upon false teachers, who by reason of their excellent endowments and esteem in the church were ready to make light of the apostle threatenings, if God did not spare the angels, and so on. Doctrine 2. It ought to be esteemed marvelous mercy in God that he does not presently thrust sinners down to hell when they provoke him, and much more that he has provided a remedy and offers pardon to them. Every moment sparing after the commission of sin should be thought wonderful indulgence in God that did not spare the angels, but, as the words in the original will bear, imprison them while they were sinning, secluding them from all possibility of hope, of recovery, forever. He did not spare the angels of sin, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains. Doctrine 3. The fallen angels, who are the devils, are under such a powerful restraint of divine providence that they cannot move or act anything but insofar as the Lord's holy justice and wisdom permits and orders them. For the punishment of the wicked, or exercise of the godly, for they are reserved in chains of darkness, which are nothing else but God's irresistible power and terrible justice overruling, tormenting and restraining them. Doctrine 4. Although the devils, when they are permitted, can appear visibly as if it were at their own liberty, and can seem jovial as if they were free of torment, 1 Samuel 28, verse 13, that so they may the more effectually prevail with poor slaves as have provoked God to give them up to their delusion, yet go where they will, their hell is always with them. They live in the constant feeling of the wrath of the Almighty as they're being delivered in chains of darkness and ports, and a dreadful expectation of a more high measure of wrath which they shall get at the day of judgment. They, together with all that serve them and follow their counsel, shall have nothing else to do but to endure torment, and shall torment one another forever, for they are delivered in chains of darkness, to be reserved unto judgment. 2 Peter 2, chapter 2, verse 5. And spare not the old world, but save Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in a flood upon the world of the ungodly. Now follows a second instance to prove the certainty of God's judgment to come upon these soul deceivers, whereof the sum is that if the old world, notwithstanding of their multitude and their long and great prosperity, were all excepting a few swept away with a flood because of their wickedness, these false teachers, notwithstanding their multitude of followers and long success in propagating their errors, have no reason to imagine to themselves an escape from the wrath of God. With which instance the apostle intermixes the example of Noah's preservation as a pledge of the Lord's respect to all who keep the way of truth and holiness in an evil time, as is clear by comparing this in the ninth verse. Although there were seven preserved from the flood beside Noah, who is therefore called the eighth, yet he is only named because he was mainly respected in that deliverance, and arrest for his cause. He is called a preacher of righteousness because even in that time he did hold forth to the people the way of free justification by the righteousness of Christ, and the duties of holiness in which justified persons ought to walk. With both which Noah had been well acquainted, as is clear by comparing Hebrews 11, verse 7 and Genesis 6, verse 9. Hence learn, number 1, there are not a few shifts in the hearts of wicked men, prospering in their sinful courses, whereby they harden themselves against the threatenings of the word of the Lord, and put the thoughts of its wrath far away from them. For after the apostle has, by the former instance of God's judgment upon the fallen angels, cut off the hopes of false teachers evading the wrath of God, because of any pretended or real excellency they had, he does by this instance prove that neither their multitude of followers nor former success could avail them, since God spared not the old world. Secondly, as the Lord uses in times of greatest affection to profanity or error to preserve a few who will bear testimony for his truth, and against the dishonor done to him by others, so he is never so terrible to the wicked but that he will remember to manifest his respect to his own few among them, who labor to keep themselves free of and mourn for these abominations which provoke him to let forth his terror. For Noah, in this instance, and Lot, in the following, are brought in as pledges of a few whom the Lord minded to preserve from that universal infection of error and vileness which was to prevail in the church of the New Testament, and whom he minded also to deliver from the plagues to follow thereupon, as appears from verse 9, but save Noah, the eighth, and so on. Number 3. Even in the very infancy of the church under the Old Testament, the way of justification by Christ's righteousness had been publicly preached, and the duties of holiness pressed upon justified persons, the study of both which ought always to be much pressed upon people by the ministers of Christ, especially in a time of abounding of iniquity and approaching of judgment, is the only way to be hid from wrath and enjoy communion with God. For Noah, in such a time, was a preacher of righteousness, both imputed and inherent, as was cleared in the exposition of this verse. Number 4. The Lord, in the dispensation of his justice, is not bound to keep the ordinary course of nature. For the illustration thereof, he may and sometimes does make the creatures move contrary to their nature, there being in them all a stronger propension so to do for their Maker's service than to move according to their ordinary course in serving their fellow creatures to his dishonor. For here, in this instance, the sea comes out of its channel at his command to drown a profane world, and in the following instance the fire comes down out of its region to burn up filthy cities, bringing in a flood upon the world of the ungodly. 2 Peter 2 verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live ungodly. Here is a third instance confirming the certainty of God's dreadful reckoning with false teachers and their followers. The sum of this is that if Sodom and Gomorrah, with other flourishing cities besides them, were for their vileness totally and terribly destroyed, and so made lasting copies of divine wrath to come upon all ungodly persons, these soul deceivers who were guilty of his high provocations and had drawn in their guilt a great number of the Lord's people could not think and reason to escape. Hence we may learn, number 1, the judgments of God upon sinful cities and incorporations used to be most terrible and exemplary, there being in them a confluence of many mercies, and so of many provocations, powerful examples to sin and bold despisings of warnings, which provokes God to make them ensamples of much wrath, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned with a total and single overthrow, as the word signifies, making them examples. Number 2. The sins of reasonable creatures provoke the Lord to write his displeasure, not only upon the persons of the sinners, but also upon the sinless and unreasonable creatures which they abuse to his dishonor. For here are the cities, comprehending both the persons of the sinners and all the plantation, or unpleasant things of Sodom, are burned to ashes and condemned with an overthrow. Number 3. However, error or heresy be often looked upon with more charity and less abhorrency than profane practices, yet shall not the judgments of heretics and their followers be inferior to the judgment of the vilest of men that ever lived. For God's judgment upon Sodom is here brought in as an ensample and pledge of his wrath to come upon the ungodly, amongst whom false teachers and their followers are mainly eyed, as is clear by considering the connection between the third verse and this. Number 4. However, sins and judgments in respect of their special nature and circumstances may vary in several times, yet the desert of every sin and the exactness of divine justice remaining still the same, former judgments of what sort soever executed upon any kind of sinners, or certain pledges of the same wrath, or the like, for substance to come upon all that walk contrary to the truth and will of God, though they were never so free of these special sins that formerly did procure that wrath. Therefore is this instance of God's judgment upon the Sodomites, as also the two former brought in here, as certain pledges of God's wrath to come upon false teachers and their followers, yea, upon all ungodly persons, making them examples, not only to those who should be found guilty of such unnatural uncleanness as the Sodomites were, but also to all that after should live ungodly, whatever their particular sin should be. Number 5. However, they that live in sin, under the light of the word, are neither willing to hear threatenings nor apply them to themselves, Isaiah 13, verse 10. Yet, it is the Lord's justice against impenitent sinners so clear in the examples here, recorded in Scripture, and the witness and deputy conscience which God has in every man's bosom so imparted, that upon serious consideration of what God's holy justice has done to sinners before, it were put to speak what men continuing in their sinful courses have to expect now. They could not be made to apply wrath to themselves, and certainly to expect it while they compare their own sins with those for which others have been punished, and do consider how impartially and immutably just he is with whom they as well as others have to do. Therefore the apostle does not express the inference which he clearly intends should be drawn from the three forenamed instances, but leaves it to the consciences of those whom he had thus been threatening, is that which they might easily conclude from this. Verses 7 and 8. And delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. For the comfort of all that mourn, for the prevailing of iniquity in those among whom they live, the apostle subjoins to the former instance the example of Lot's preservation, whom the Spirit of the Lord that indicated the Scripture commends by several expressions of great respect for his deep resentment of the sympathy with the Lord's suffering, honor, and for these vile Sodomites amongst whom Providence had cast his lot for a time. Hence we may learn, the dearest of the children of the Lord may be put by his providence to have their residence amongst the worst of men. The Lord, by this correcting and humbling them for their too low esteem and little use, making of better society while they had it, fault of which it seems Lot was not altogether free. And by this also giving them occasion to do good to the souls of their godless neighbors, and bear witness against their wickedness, both which Lot endeavored to do, Genesis 19, verse 7, who for these and other reasons had his lot among the Sodomites for a time. But secondly, it is not impossible for the children of the Lord living among the most profane to retain their integrity and have the Lord's approval for their disposition and carriage, there being much more power in the grace of Christ and his indwelling Spirit in them than there is in the temptations of Satan, or the example of the wicked, notwithstanding all their terrors and allurements. For Lot, among the Sodomites, is approved and commended as a just and a righteous man. Thirdly, it is the kind disposition of a true penitent to be so far from taking pleasure in the sins of others, as the wicked do, Romans 1:32, that he will be much vexed in soul, and will account it his duty to put himself to much grief, as the words in the original here signify, while he ponders, and is a witness of his dishonor that is forgiven him. For so was it with the penitent and pardoned Lot. He was vexed, which is a passive word, and did vex, which is an active, his righteous soul with the filthy conversation and unjust deeds of the Sodomites. 4. The sympathizing frame of spirit, with the Lord's suffering honor, is much taken notice of by him, both to reward it graciously and to punish him that occasion that grief to his people. Therefore, both the expressions of Lot's vexation and of the Lord's respect to him are frequently repeated here. Just Lot was vexed, and did vex, his righteous soul. 5. It is a privilege of a true penitent to be in no less esteem with a merciful God, and to find no less expressions of respect from him than if he had never sinned against him. For though Lot, not without guiltiness, separated himself from Abraham, choosing Sodom to live in for a better worldly accommodation, for which he met with much oppression and soul vexation, both which the word in the original signifies, yet the Lord did not only preserve his memory and esteem by these manifold expressions of his respect to him, he delivered just Lot, that righteous man, who vexed his righteous soul. 6. When men are left of God to follow the inclination of their corrupt nature, they will go to such a height of wickedness as ought not to be mentioned without abhorrency. They will not be restrained by any law. They'll be cast aside all their modesty and avow their vileness in their outward conversation. A natural sense will become the very element in which they will not weary to waste themselves daily. All which is signified by these words here in the original in which the carriage of the Sodomites is set forth, and by the apostle speaking of it with so great detestation. Well, he says Lot was vexed with his filthy conversation of the wicked, and did vex his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. 2:9. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust to the day of judgment to be punished. This verse contains the application of all the former instances and a conclusion drawn from them, especially for the comfort of the godly, as also for the terror of the wicked, who ought both to draw the inference which is here from the former examples. And from this we learn, 1, although there be now no ordinary warrant to expect such an extraordinary way of preservation from common calamities, as some of the saints have found before, yet that same wisdom, power, and loving God, which wrought deliverance for them, being engaged in the covenant of grace to be forthcoming for all of his own, in the way that may be most for his honor and their good, all who imitate these saints in fearing threatened judgments, in mourning for and keeping themselves free of the causes procuring them, and in the use of the commanded means for their preservation, may take their extraordinary deliverances recorded in Scripture for pledges to them, either of exemption from the outward calamity, if that be for their good, or of the equivalent of it, or rather that which will be better for them. To wit, such a measure of the Lord's presence under it as changes the nature of it to them, or their full deliverance both from sin and trouble by it. For Noah and Lot's preservation, which were extraordinary, are here held forth as useful for ordinary believers, so that they might draw this comfortable conclusion: the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation. But secondly, it is the lot of the truly godly to be brought into many and great straits, not only by outward troubles, but by inward temptations, both which come ordinarily together upon the children of the Lord. That so their manifold corruptions may be borne down, the several graces of God's Spirit in them tried and increased by exercise, and the power, faithfulness, and love of Christ manifested and committed in their through bearing and deliverance. For they from whom case this inference is drawn were in both these exercises at once. And the word temptation here does ordinarily in Scripture signify both afflictions and temptations to sin. Number 3. When the children of the Lord are exercised with outward afflictions and inward temptations, they are also oftentimes both ignorant of a way of delivery and anxious concerning it. If their straits that they are in and their way out of them were hid from the Lord, as it is Isaiah 40:27. For this consolation, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly, is fitted for such a case, and so to suppose it to be ordinary. Number 4. The Lord's taken notice of the straits of the godly, and his knowledge of the way of their deliverance should be to them a sufficient ground of comfort, both against their straits and their ignorance of a way of escape. His love, having engaged his power and faithfulness to make forthcoming for them everything his infinite wisdom sees to be most for their good. For this very end, is this consolation given to the godly. The Lord knows how to deliver them out of temptation, that they may be comforted both against their straits and their ignorance of a way of delivery. Number 5. Whether the Lord spare wicked men, or let out the earnest of his wrath upon them in this life, yet is the full measure of it keeping to the fore for them against the day of judgment, when they shall be made able to endure that wrath, a sparkle of which would now undo them. Therefore their terror is this conclusion also drawn from the former examples. The Lord knows how to reserve the unjust to the day of judgment to be punished.